The math is very complicated. So we spent more than a year just getting the math right. I think my wife is like ridiculously cool. They had to walk maybe like 5 miles to get to the school every day. Like, so I went, took an application and filled it up. And I took to my dad saying, hey, he had to sign. And my dad asked, hey, what is this for? He looked at it and he just tore the application. So he said, no, you're not doing that. Go get a degree. So I don't know what this is, but I need to go figure this shit out. Hey.
Nice.
I love you, Texas.
Hey, guys, I'm Young, a full-time dad and a full-time professional with the goal to become the best parent possible. The Girl Dad Show is my journey interviewing fellow working parents aspiring to be both good at work and parenting. I'm going to do this by gathering and sharing unfiltered perspectives from my guests. So join me as I research parenthood one interview at a time.
This episode of The Girl Dad Show is brought to you by 212. Among the many things that I do, I'm also an angel investor. The two biggest mistakes I see founders make when they come to me for investments are one, they don't have a clean cap table, and two, they are unable to clearly articulate how my equity will dilute over future rounds, and more importantly, what my ROI will be when the company exits. It's very difficult for me to make my investment decisions without these data points. 212 solves this problem for both me and the founders. For $240 a year, 212 offers an incredibly powerful cap table management and valuation modeling platform. It is by far one of the most powerful productivity tools I've seen, and I highly recommend every founder sign up. Modeling convertible notes, safes, price rounds, pro rata, liquidation preferences, and exit events is a breeze on 212. Founders can then easily share all these complex calculations and what-if scenarios with investors and close their round much quicker. They're also giving my listeners 25% off their first year's membership costs if you use the discount code TGDS at checkout. And if you're a founder or investor, you should absolutely get on 212 as soon as possible. It's an absolute no-brainer. Dilution is real and complex. Cap table management is confusing and expensive. You need to get on 212 today. What's the point of building a successful company you don't own?
Rajesh, thank you so much for joining me on my podcast today.
Awesome, man. Like, pleasure to speak with you, Young.
It's so fun to be able to talk to you about parenting in addition to all the stuff that we talk about with 212.
Yeah. I remember like when you and I, one of our first meetings, I kind of started getting into parenting and you said, hold on, I don't want to hear anything right now. Let's wait for the podcast before you tell me more. So yeah.
I told you to save it, huh? I was like, save it for the podcast.
Don't tell me anything though, yeah.
Well, let's get the listeners caught up to our relationship. So why don't you tell everyone what you do for a living?
So I'm in the startup ecosystem for the past 16 years plus. So living is a very strong word. So it's more of what I do for surviving. So currently I'm a co-founder of a startup called 212. And the idea for 212 really came about because of a lot of the problems that I saw with founders giving up too much equity away too soon. And in the process, they either lose control of the company or they get acquired and the investors kind of pick up majority of the lion's share when the company exits. And I've been at three other startups before and I've seen this happen over and over, and I've been talking to a lot of other startup founders and I see it's a very common pattern. The problem that I see is that founders are super focused on the problem they're trying to solve, the market they're going after, the customers they want to service, building the actual product and so on. But in the process, they kind of lose sight of equity, which is the most important piece for which what they're working for. Because as an investor, the investors really care about the equity component. But the founders put that in the back burner and not focus on that piece as much. So what I'm trying to do here at 212 is allow founders to also think about their equity in front and center. And the reason they're not doing that as well today is because there are no tools and data available at a startup-friendly price. There are tools out there, but it's much more pricier. So they have to cough up, say, $5,000 to get some of these tools. So at 212, what we've done is we make all these data and tools available at say $20 a month, right? So that's our starting price for the cap table. So it just makes it easy for them to understand how the ownership in the company will dilute over a period of time. So that's a core piece of 212 as a startup. But besides that, I'm also running the managing director for a pre-seed accelerator called Founders Boost, where we help so many other founders come in and help them be laser focused on their next milestone traction. And in the process, I get to speak with so many founders and understand their problems. And I also teach so many sessions about equity cap table. So it's like a mix of different things in the startup ecosystem. That's pretty much what I do of late for the past 3 years, maybe.
Yeah, that's awesome, man. And I think that if like you really dig into it, it's so funny because people don't realize how irrefutable it is once you get into a term sheet, right? And so how damaging that can be for the founder as they start to get into like the fourth or fifth round of funding and not being able to calculate the dilution that you're going through and, you know, exiting these companies or even like getting acquired or going public is like such a rarity. And then just to find out that you've been diluted so much because, you know, calculating post safes and convertible notes and warrants and discounts, I mean, it just is so hard to calculate that. Understand and forecast it. So I think it's really incredible. I mean, the moment I heard about the product, I was like, yeah, this is exactly what's needed right now. Because I think so many founders don't even realize why it's so important. You know, it's like you're going to work your brains out, you know, to, you know, build your passion or build your company and not even realize what the exit plan looks like for you, right? And you kind of don't actually really hear about it either. I mean, not too many people talk about like their exits and you know, and then the reality of how little they actually got out of the exit, you know, typically. And it's just one of those things that's really, really fascinating. Why do you think that is?
So I think it is because of lack of education, in my opinion. So if you think about, okay, how many founders took their company through IPO, where the founder still held majority control or of the common shares at least? They're not too many, right? So you can actually count in two hands how many of those companies you can probably recall. Typically what happens is founders come in, they try to solve a problem and they raise one or two rounds of capital and they get kicked out because there's no lack of traction. And then all of a sudden the ownership dilutes. So for personally, I can give you some examples that I'm very intimately familiar with. So there was this founder that raised $15 million at a $60 million valuation pre-revenue, and they didn't hit the traction that they thought they'll hit. So all of a sudden there was a down round and the founder, CEO got kicked out. They brought in some professional founders. They were also pretty bad. But again, so, and then it went through an acquisition, but the investors took the money out. So none of the common shareholders got anything. So that's a very typical, and I've seen that happen over and over. And that's because of these mistakes, right? So I also see a lot of founders coming saying, I'm pre-revenue, pre-seed, I need $3 million. So and I'm like, okay, why do you need $3 million? What can you do with $200,000? Mm. So they don't understand this piece. And then and I see that when I put it, this in front of some of my customers, and I don't give them the answer, but I tell them, hey, this is a tool, start modeling your cap table, how things evolve. And so there's an example customer of mine, he's raised capital on safes and convertible notes, and then he's looking to raise another big chunk on another safe. What he didn't recognize was that, okay, he needs to convert things first, right? So if your investors have not taken ownership personally in the company, and then they don't dilute their ownership interest when you take new capital. So. So one of the things he did was, okay, so he basically modeled a scenario where he converted the existing investors on a safe and note, and then he raised capital, and then he also took another model where he didn't convert them, and he saw, hey, okay, so this is a big difference of, say, 5% that he was not capturing because his investors were not converting. So he changed his plan. So he got into a system, and then he said, okay, why am I raising this much? So I should be raising much smaller, converting everybody, and then raise at a higher valuation as the company evolves. So these are like trigger points, right? So I keep seeing a lot of founders getting exposed to these kind of scenarios, and there is like another piece of the brain wiring that gets hooked. And now they're like, okay, yeah, I didn't recognize this. So this is new information to me. And to answer your question, I think it's because they don't have access to tools. Today, for example, most of them try to model this out on a spreadsheet, and you can do a lot of things. So spreadsheet is limited in the sense that if you have a pre-money safe, post-money safe, a convertible note, and convertible note in different terms, now all of a sudden you're not sure about the math.
You can visually see how things evolve.
Right? So,
well, it's also really interesting too about like the raise and go milestone tactic that you you use at 212, but also that you really educate a lot of founders on, and it's really, really smart. And and I'll be very, very transparent here. I actually never thought about it that way either. And I was like, huh, because like even this next round, you know, it's like, why aren't you raising more? And it's kind of like, why would I? I should raise what I need to raise so that I can get to the next milestone, so the valuation of my company goes up and it increases the chances of me continuing to succeed and hit specific milestones and grow the company, but also, you know, manage and mitigate too much dilution unnecessarily. It's really interesting. I mean, it does take a little bit of planning and a little bit of thought, but the visibility of understanding your dilution and cap table is so powerful and so important. I have a thesis that I think it's because it's just so complicated. I think that it's so complicated and so advanced that like most founders should know about it, but they get embarrassed about asking questions about it or that they don't understand it, right? And so I think there's a lot of stigma around just the whole act of fundraising. It's like it just makes it hard for people to ask questions and be new to it. So I think that's kind of one of the things that I see. I don't know if you've noticed that at all.
Yeah, it is complicated, right? So the math is very complicated. So we spent more than a year just getting the math right. Because when you have all these different instruments and you have liquidation preferences, you have pro rata participation, the math needs to work. And yeah. One of the common problems that I see is that investors could go to the founders and say, okay, I'll give you the $200,000, but what's my ROI? When you go to Series A, Series B and exit, or Series A and exit, or Series A through IPO. And these founders don't have an easy answer for that, right? So they typically end up spending like 2 to 3 weeks building a spreadsheet model, not building the business, but building a spreadsheet model to answer that question. And 3 weeks later, they go back to the investor, but the investor deployed capital elsewhere because somebody else gave him the right answer and now the money is gone. So they just wasted 3 weeks building a spreadsheet model, right? So, and it is complicated. And you, if you don't trust your spreadsheet model, then you just don't trust anything. So so now the investor is not confident, the founder is not confident, and they end up losing that that ability to raise capital. So.
Yeah, I love talking to you about this stuff. I learned so much since I've been working with you at 212 and just like understanding the product in this space, because it's like so such an untalked about area for most founders. Yeah. And it's so important. So I really appreciate that. But that being said, we went super dense into something that probably most people are like, what? So let's talk a little bit about being a parent. So I'm really curious about you as a dad, and I definitely want to ask if you're teaching your kids hyper-focused on math and cap table management. But before we get in there, tell me about your kids.
So I have three kids. So my oldest son, he's actually a sophomore at Purdue University studying aerospace engineering. My second one is a daughter. She's a junior at high school. And my third one is a son who is a sixth grader in the middle school here. So three kids, super happy about everything that they're accomplishing.
That's amazing. Yeah, sounds like they definitely took off of your intellectual horsepower there and their love for math and engineering, huh?
I think this, even my wife, Rashmi, she is an engineer herself. She's also a computer science engineer. So she and I met while working at IBM. So obviously she also shares in some of the credit.
Yeah, that's awesome.
I think I give her more credit than I would take the credit.
Why is that?
Her thought process is very different than what I've seen from other women. I think my wife is like ridiculously cool. So and that's one of the reasons I was attracted to her. So she has a very different mindset that it's very difficult to get her to get angry, right? So she doesn't get angry at all.
So that
perspective. And then even from my side, like I keep talking to my kids about different things, so I come up with different topics. So I remember once when I was driving my kids, my son, he was probably in his second grade, and my daughter was in in daycare. So those are the times when I spend a lot of time talking to my kids, right? Mm. Okay, so, and this
commute
is like
to school.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah. Driving them to school, and it's usually about a 30-minute drive to school those days. And I remember telling my oldest son about, I think this was a credit crisis that was happening. So I was just kind of describing to him what money is, right? So I was giving the example of Haiti and Dominican Republic and the same island, two different countries, two different economy. And he was, like I said, he was in the second or third grade. And my son was listening to this piece and we didn't, he didn't say anything. So I was like, dude, okay, this is too complex above the head kind of thing. And then a few weeks later, I talked to him about the situation in Greece, I think, or maybe one of those places where, again, some economical situation was happening. And then he kind of connected the two together. So he was saying, okay, so that makes sense. Why this company went into a debt crisis? I'm like, dude, what are you talking about? Dude, yeah. How do you even pick up these things? Yeah. So he kind of surprised me in the sense, like he was putting all the different pieces together. He was building a story. So that's how I find my son. He's my oldest son, Surya, is pretty unique in that aspect. So he can take very disconnected ideas and kind of tie them together. So I don't know. I don't know if I contributed to that or my wife contributed, but that's a good example of.
Yeah, I'm sure you did. I can't imagine both you guys not contributing to it. I mean, what I found out is like even what you don't do contributes to your kids' development.
Yeah.
So yeah, by default you are, and I'm sure. I mean, you are working on some of the most complex problems, you know, and so I'm sure that carries over. Do you talk to all your kids about like math and analytics and kind of money and all that stuff? Or
We talk about different. So usually when I find, I'm a very visual person and I like storytelling a lot, right? Hmm. So I find certain things and I try to get some insight about some event. So recently, for example, I was telling my kids about. I'll probably bring some of the. Indian aspects. Okay, so
yeah,
so there was this album. So A.R. Rahman is one of the world famous music directors out of India. Mm-hmm. So he actually won a couple of Oscars for his work in Slumdog Millionaire. So
maybe, oh, nice. Yeah. Yeah. Cool.
Yeah. Yeah. So and I kind of look at some of the things that that have happened to some of his albums. I binge on interviews when not the main person, but others around the production. I look at all their interviews and see, okay, what is the learning here? That's pretty much where I spend a lot of my time when I'm not working on 212 or anything work related. So this incident, so there was this album called Vande Mataram. Okay, so it's basically a very patriotic album, and it was created about 50 years after India won independence. And so the person who created this album, his name is Bharat Bala. And what he did was, when he came up with the idea for, okay, let's go try to recreate the passion for Indian patriotism. So that was the idea behind it. He was actually creating jingles for, basically he was producing different ads for different companies like saris or scooters or whatever. And then his dad basically asking, hey, why don't you kind of market India to the Indian citizens? So that was like a much bigger idea at that point. So what Bharat Bala did was he went to this artist named Thota Tharani and told him, hey, this is what I want to get out of this. So why don't you paint me something? I want the album cover to be painted, right? So, and this guy, this artist went and painted on a giant canvas, like red, orange, green, white, yellow. So he kind of put like, it kind of represents the Indian flag that's kind of flaming. And what Bharat Bala did was he took a picture of that that painting and he put it into an empty cassette cover. So mm-hmm. he put it inside a cassette cover and shipped it to A.R. Rahman, right? And A.R. Rahman received this. He opened it and he saw this cover and there's nothing inside it, but it was a cassette cover with this.
Yeah.
And he was like, dude, okay, this is something different, all right? So it basically attacked him in a different vector altogether. compared to just going and telling and trying to sell the story to him. It was a different vector. So I go to my kids and when I hear something like this, I go tell them, hey, okay, so this is what happened. So it kind of induces different emotions in my kids or my wife. Oh, okay, this is very interesting perspective. So I keep doing things like that. So when I find something interesting, I go talk to them, hey, this just happened, right? So
that's so interesting. You're like pulling stories that you can use that are relevant to today's time and then find like the lesson in it. And so exactly. One for you, and you're also looking for those creative ways that people succeed or create success. And then you're basically creating like conversation points with your kids.
100%,
That's amazing. Because I was going to say like the whole Haiti and I don't remember what other country said, the economy conversation sounds incredibly dense.
Yeah,
so it's
yeah.
just like, it's like, why would you even think to talk about that, right? So I was just more curious about it, but that is really fascinating. Were your parents like that as well with you?
Actually, no. So so my parents, they grew up in a village, okay? They grew up in a village, remote part of South India in a state called Kerala. And they actually grew up the hard way, right? So it is a very typical Asian parent situation where my dad, for example, or even my mom, they and the entire family, right? So the entire generation, they had to walk maybe like 5 miles to get to the school every day. Like, and they grew up in like poverty situation, like it was below poverty or poverty line. So that's how they grew up. And I know this... I haven't asked my dad this, but I know based on my conversation with my dad. So for him, two things really mattered. One was food. So because I know he grew up hungry, literally hungry. And second was education, because he, after his high school, he started off as a stenographer. So working as an executive assistant.
Oh, wow.
And he kind of worked his way to become the manager of a big operation. And he's seen these two are big problems of his life, right? So one is get good education. The second is make sure there's food to eat 3 or 4 times a day. So those are the things that he really focused on. And for me, for example, as I was growing up, I was in in the mid 80s and early 90s, India was super backward. Okay, so yeah. There was no access to information. Whatever happened was the information you got was from newspapers, right? So, and that's it. So
it was even staggered, yeah. So it wasn't like on demand, yeah.
Yeah, because television came to India only in the early 80s, and it took maybe another 5 years before there was some adoption of television. Because people didn't know what this thing would do, whether it was a very expensive investment for Indians. So they had to work their way to save enough money to buy a TV. And once TV came in, okay, it was like 2 hours of television every day, and primarily news, right? So the environment was such that, okay, there's limited information input coming in, and we just, there's only so much things that we could do. So, I recall, once, when I was finishing up my 10th grade, and I was thinking, okay, what should I do next? Right. So one of the options I had was to get into what is called a polytechnic, where they teach you to become a labor force. Right. Mm. So this particular one, I spoke to my brother's friend. He said he's studying something to build tiles, okay? And he said, okay, you get paid 5,000 rupees per month once you learn this. I said, okay, that's pretty cool. So let me go do this. So I went, took an application and filled it up. And I took to my dad saying, hey, he had to sign in a section to say he authorizes this. So I took it to him, and my dad asked, okay, what is this for? So he said, this is a polytechnic course. I can manufacture tiles and earn 5,000 rupees a month. So he looked at it and he just tore the application. So he said, no, you're not doing that. Go get a degree.
Oh, wow.
For it was very cut and dry. So there's nothing else. Dude, you get a degree because he, as growing up, he's seen others with degree do well in life. So for him, it is very clear. Dude, don't screw up your life. This is not negotiable. So
long-term growth and success over the short term, right? That's kind of what he was looking at.
Yeah, I think for it, again, so those are the learnings for him, right? Education is very important, and make sure that translates to getting there is food on the table 4 times a day kind of thing. I think that's what his mindset was. Yeah. I didn't ask him directly, but I think that's how he operated.
I'd say it's pretty classic, right? Classic.
Yeah.
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 from that generation for sure. I think that, like, you know, it's a really important thing to, like, help the kids level up. I do have to ask, how much of that has impacted you and your kids?
So
you're living a very different life than your parents did.
Oh, 100%, man. So, again, so I think if you ask anybody else from India, like, I would say, like, 90 to 80% above will tell the same story as what I'm saying, okay? So, like, so we all grew up as either middle class or lower middle class, upper middle class, like, five people living in a 800 square footage house. Our apartment, we rented those. So it's a very typical scenario that happens in India. Things have changed now, but at least my generation pretty much grew up in that environment. And we were all looking for, okay, what is the next big thing that we wanted to get into? Where is the arbitrage? Like, where mm-hmm. can we differentiate ourselves? I think in the early 90s, when I was kind of getting into my education, my graduation time frame, electronics was the thing. So television had just come in, and there were VCRs that happened, and that market was basically booming. And so to me, it was okay. My older brother basically took that route, right? So, and he was a freaking genius in electronics. So somehow he picked up, so he used to kind of build television at home. Like, he would buy these kits and put television and audio players together. So it was just outrageous what he was doing. And so I thought, okay, maybe that's the only path I have. And so I remember once I was at my cousin's house, my cousin Shija's house. A bunch of other cousins of mine had shown up, and we were all talking. And one of my other cousins, Girish, so he told us that, hey, a friend of his studied something called computer science. And he went to the US and he's working there. And that's all I heard. And this was the entire day. And that's it. So I'm like, hey, so it looks like there's something called computers. So I don't know what this is, but I need to go figure this shit out.
Yeah.
So that's pretty much what I did. So after that, then I basically went and found whatever materials I could get out of computer science, and internet was the first thing that I heard.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah. So, and then to me, it was, hey, okay, that's the thing that I need to get into, right? So now that I've been through this process, I've worked at IBM, Sun Microsystems, Motorola, been part of different startups. To me, like, it is very clear that startup is the thing. Like, you need to start businesses, you need to own equity in your business, and take it through exit, build solutions that solves a world problem. So now I tell my kids, what do you want to do? Don't go work at SpaceX or wherever. Go start your own business.
Go start SpaceX. Yeah, that's awesome.
So it doesn't handle SpaceX, but build a company that can be leveraged by SpaceX. Right?
Yeah, I was going to ask you that. So I like that you answered it already. So you are pushing them to be entrepreneurial.
100%. So I tell them, there's no point going and working for somebody else. So you get frustrated, especially when you have a management that doesn't see the vision that you see. So I tell them, okay, you can go do what you want. It's okay. Like, I don't stop you from going and working at SpaceX or Virgin Atlantic or wherever. Do it, but consider starting your own business. Okay, that's where you have more control on how you want. Okay, otherwise, my older son, for example, like, he is an intellect, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. So a lot of when he sees people not performing, he says, man, that guy, that girl, it's too much work. So what I tell him, hey, dude, okay, this is really what you going to happen. You go join any company, you'll be surrounded by a few people who are not up to that par. So it can frustrate you, but instead, go start your own business so you can control and manage it.
Yeah, you're too kind. I think the percentages are the opposite of that. But yeah, I think there's a few people that are, you know, incredibly motivated and inspired, and then the rest of them are just, you know, making money. But I am so fascinated by the fact that you actually are pushing them to that. I just assumed that, you know, because of the degree that they're choosing and the fact that they're in engineering, that you wanted them to go get that kind of stability and kind of grow in as a company man. You're the opposite. What does your wife think about that?
Oh, so she is pretty cool. Again, so to me, it is, it's just storytelling, right? So to me, it's like I tell her stories. So I think that's the cool thing about my wife is she loves to hear my stories. So the way I see this is, in general, like, so again, I might kind of deviate here and there, but there's like a bandwidth, okay, in which everybody operates, mm-hmm. and there is noise on top and noise at the bottom, right? So within that, okay, everything is going fine and everybody's kind of bouncing around. But sometimes you hit the top noise factor or the bottom noise factor, and then that noise factor comes in different forms, right? So it could be the progress report of my kids show that, okay, they received a B. So let's go see what happened there. It could be, okay, this friend did some weird shit. So, okay, let's go see what happened. So that's it. So I kind of wait for these ends to be hit. And when they hit, then, okay, I get into a storytelling mode. Okay, this happened in my life, or this happened to my friend, whatever. So, and then I kind of try to bring it down. So, I show some of the emails that I receive from my customers saying, hey, okay, dude, you really made me better, or made my company better. So, and I show that to my wife, and my wife looks at it. Okay, so this makes sense. So she's pretty cool and bought into it, and she's perfectly fine with that. Okay,
yeah, so I mean, it's great that both of you guys are into it. I mean, just because it's like the entrepreneurial journey. I mean, it's so amazing that you're so confident that you want your kids to become entrepreneurs, but it's also riddled with risk.
100%. Yeah, 100%. Yeah, I think the rule of thumb is. The rule of thumb, generally, what I've heard is that, okay, an entrepreneur is successful in the fifth startup. So they make all the mistakes in the first four startups. So that's where a lot of the investors say, okay, what have you done before in the startup ecosystem?
That's right.
I think I've read somewhere that Andreessen Horowitz won't invest in first-time founders. So they say, okay, have you started a business before, or have you been an early employee at one of the startups? That's minimum criteria for them to
makes a lot of sense. Yeah. Because it's super hard. It's super, super hard.
It is. And I think that's what accelerators do, right? So they are trying to kind of mitigate that risk factor by getting founders access to partners who have done this before, or vendors who help these companies understand some of the nuances of starting businesses. To me, that piece is important. You can kind of de-risk quite a bit, but still there are founders out there who need some more coaching because a lot of the pieces are not falling in place, in which case, yeah, they may fail the first time, but they learn from it and they're successful second. They don't have to wait for four failures before they're successful, so we're trying to reduce it.
So taking that concept and taking the fact that you want your kids to be entrepreneurs, are you comfortable with the fact that they're going to fail a couple of times?
Oh, 100%. I want them to fail, right? So you don't learn anything if you don't fail. And I like the fact that even Amazon, for example, so in their interviews, they pretty much ask, where have you failed? That's really what they want to know. Like if you are somebody who's had successes after successes, they don't hire you. It's not a criteria for them. So they want to make sure that you failed and what you learned from that failure. So to me, I tell my kids, okay, until you are 25 years old, I want you to fail 1,000 times. I don't care. So just keep failing and learn from it before you get to a point where you're not failing. And I keep encouraging them. So, okay, you got to fail. Otherwise, you don't learn from it.
It's awesome. So then if you had to qualify success as a parent, what does parenting mean to you now?
So to me, it is just giving them an environment where they can think through themselves and be confident about failing, be confident about trying experiments, and giving them some guidance for, hey, these are the two limits I was telling you about. Okay, so you're hitting these limits, and I think you got to be careful because these are the drawbacks of hitting those limits on either side. But giving them that environment where they can think and operate on their own. So my daughter, for example, so. She likes to interact with people a lot, right? Mm. So she's very passionate about being in front of people and getting to know people. So she and a friend started like a nonprofit called Cards for Life. Okay.
Wow.
So all they do is they basically sing. So they go to different old age homes, for example, and they sing different musical pieces. And it makes a difference to the lives of these individuals that are listening to them. And that's pretty much what she's kind of passionate about, that piece, right? So, and then she wants to get into the medical field so she can help more and more people. But what I tell her is the way I look at a person's 100% time is I kind of break it up into three pieces. One is the me time, right? So like where I want to spend my time, it could be watching a rerun of Office or playing some video games or whatever. And then you have a work component. You need to do something for a living, or if you're a student, you need to study something. And then you have a family component. So it's basically three things. So me time, work, study, and family. And that's your 24 hours and 100%. And it's how much percentage you allocate to each piece. So what I tell my kids is, okay, if you are passionate about the work that you want to do, then your me time and work becomes a much bigger portion of your life. So you can kind of focus on that. So my the other day, just last week, I was telling my daughter that, okay, if her goal is to spend more time with people, and get to in front of people, being a doctor need not be the way to get it, right? So there are many ways. You can be a marketer and do the exact same thing, and you may be able to do it at scale. You may be able to hit, say, a million potential people than talking to, say, 20 patients in a day, right? So what I've been telling her, okay, make sure you're kind of passionate about the work that you do so that you can eat into your me time. So you're giving more to the work that you're doing.
Yeah, it's like allocating into buckets, right? Like, and thinking about it more of like in a macro. That's great, man. I love it.
Yeah.
I do want to be cognizant of the time, so let me jump into some of the rapid fire questions I have for every guest. Okay.
Sure.
If you could give any advice to other parents and soon to be parents, what advice would you give?
I think the most important thing is to have a very open channel. So you should set an environment so that they feel comfortable coming to you as a parent and talking about their problems. It could be like a small problem, like, okay, this guy kicked me yesterday or threw a rock at me. So this is a problem that I'm trying to solve, and I don't know how to approach this problem. So it could be any of those, but the important thing is that, okay, you should allow anyone to walk in, any of your kids to walk in and talk to you. So, for example, I see that, like, some of your videos, your kids just walk in and you just pick them up.
Yeah.
That is the right thing to do, right? So they should feel confident that, hey, it's okay. Like, I can go and knock on his door anytime. So that's the most important piece, in my opinion.
Wow. That's awesome. I like that you're so confident about that. Makes me feel good. If you can go back and tell yourself one thing before having kids, what would you tell yourself?
I think spend more time with your wife or spouse, right?
Mm.
So let me kind of break it down from a mathematical standpoint, right? So what I tell my kids, my oldest son, right? So when when we had just our first child, he got 100% of our attention, right? And then when my daughter was born, like, his 100% became 50% from a mathematical standpoint. And then I had my third son, he went down to 33%. So he lost like big time, like 69% or whatever. It's a big chunk he lost. But whereas my daughter came in, she was already at 50-50, and then she lost like a smaller chunk. And when my third son was born, his world of truth is 33%. So he's not feeling one way or the other. But the person who lost the most was my wife, right? So she was at 100%, she went down to 25%. So we don't talk about it. But she and I, we spent maybe 2 years before we got married. In hindsight, okay, maybe we should have taken more time before having a family. But our situation was very different, so it didn't matter. But I think for others who are planning to have family and children, spend more time with each other, get to know each other.
Wow, that's awesome. Yeah. I love it. So what's the most surprising thing that you've learned about yourself after becoming a parent?
To me, it's not easy, right? Becoming a parent, and especially if you're a first-time parent, it's not easy. Like, so there's a lot of curveballs there. And for me specifically, the problem was that I didn't have a lot of support system. Okay, so we had just moved in from India, like, we're just setting up shop in the US, we didn't have too many friends, or friends that we had didn't have kids. So we were probably the first couple amongst my friend group that had a child. So, but in India, it's a different story because you have family support that can be tapped into. So to me and my wife, that was the biggest challenge. It was not easy, like having a kid, being by ourselves. So so to me, that was a surprising part. Okay, I thought it would be easy, but it was not easy. Like there was a process, and I was really young when I had my oldest son. And even that mental maturity in me was not there. So I had to kind of quickly ramp up. It took me a while. And I know that my wife was super matured. But and she would kind of point out, hey, you're kind of missing on these 50 things that you should be doing. And it took me a while before I kind of totally appreciated it. I think to me that was my experience.
It's awesome. And then let me switch gears a little bit. What's your all-time favorite business book? Now that I know you love stories, this is going to be a good one. Yeah.
For me, I think Phil Knight's book Shoe Dog. Is my all-time favorite. Okay, wow. So he talks about how he started Nike and how he failed. Like he kept failing. Like there's like obstacles after obstacles, and he just the company should not have existed today. And just all the perseverance that he had to endure to make that company what it is today. So it's just an amazing, fascinating book about that journey of Nike. To me, that is the all-time favorite.
Wow.
Super. Yeah.
Yeah, I can see why. That's awesome. You definitely live that kind of lifestyle where you're like, hey, go get it, you know, and keep trying. So that's fantastic. I have one last question, Rajesh. What do you do when you're having fun? What do you do for yourself? What's your hobby? What's this Rajesh time look like?
So for me, like I try to pick up, say, two hobbies every 6 months. Okay. So so previously it was, okay, astrophotography was something that I kind of pick up, and then I spend 6 months just understanding that piece and spend a lot of time understanding the theory behind it, taking a lot of pictures and building these things. So something that is not normal. I try to do something that's difficult.
Yeah.
And I spend six months trying to master that piece. And I pick two different hobbies every 6 months, and then I kind of keep up with it even after 6 months. But now I'm trying to learn flute, like an Indian bamboo flute.
Oh, wow.
So I'm trying to pick that up. But again, I have a dog here and he doesn't like it. It's basically, so that's one piece. And I had skateboarding as my second one, but I got busy with another program setting up a fund instance, so that kind of took up my time. But yeah, so skateboard is going to be in the next of the list for me.
Nice. Hey, well, definitely let me know when you start picking up the skateboard. I'm happy to ride with you. I definitely could even show you around a little bit. Yeah.
So I picked up rollerblades at one point. So I can rollerblade, but now skateboard is a different beast altogether. So
it is, yeah. I love rollerblading too. So let me know if you want to rollerblade as well.
Yeah, we should. Yeah.
I love anything with wheels. Anything with wheels, I love. Yeah. That was awesome, Rajesh. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me about 212, your philosophies on life and business. And it's so fun to know that you have like an adult kid, like an adult child. I never even, you know, like realized that. It's just so great to like hear all the experience that you've had just growing up with it. So I really appreciate you taking the time.
Yeah, sure thing, man. Pleasure.
Yeah, thank you, brother. Talk to you soon.
Okay, later, bye.
Thanks for tuning in to another episode of The Girl Dad Show. We really hope you enjoyed that interview. And as always, please take a moment to review, rate, and subscribe. We'll see you next time.